This is Joaquin Flores, geopolitical analyst, and now you're going to learn the foundation of U.S. doctrine in international relations, which primarily informs military thinking. And now it's often a surprise to Americans how much the civilian and academic sphere in international relations informs military thinking. And while the leading generals in the United States have to have a background in international relations, the questions of military tactics, supply lines, are separate from the broader geopolitical and geoeconomic factors, as well as general risk assessments made by leaders in analyzing the motivations of states, falls not under the rubric of military thinking, although it informs military thinking. It comes from my field, international relations. So now in the US, probably one of the biggest thinkers whose theory of offensive realism, it was from the early 80s during the Reagan administration, is the realist John Mearsheimer. And Mearsheimer is very important as a thinker, and he was someone that we studied back in the university, and I had the pleasure of hearing a lecture as well. And you can find him, I think, probably anywhere on the internet and see what he's all about. But I can give you an idea is in the realism school, you basically have two main schools of thought in IR. And it used to be more clear cut going back, of course, to the time of E.H. Carr, who is many believe to be probably the founder of modern international relations. That's E.H. Carr. At any rate, you have realism and idealism, but within those you have neo-realism, neo-idealism, and so forth. Also, Marxism in IR was pretty dominant in terms of within the rubric of Sovietology and understanding the IR proclivities of the Warsaw Pact, but also one can use Marxist analysis in IR. There's derivatives and so forth, but that has more or less been abandoned. And anyhow, Marxism in IR was closest to realism in IR, which is very interesting because idealism is associated with liberal views of IR, and realism is associated with conservative views of IR, but Marxism is closest to conservatism in its realist view of the dynamics of forces in the world, where states act as rational actors within an ocean or within a terrain of anarchy and unpredictability between players. So the interesting thing in John Mearsheimer's neo-realism, I would say, is the idea of how is actually relates to actually Baudrillardian ideas, whether he didn't frame it this way, but in fact they are, about simulacrum and hyperreality. And this is what I mean by that. So he is of the view, and this is doctrine in the United States. So when I talk about, I'm not talking about, this is just an interesting guy to think about. This is what's informing U.S. thinking prior to, I guess you could call the White Hats, change on this approach, because his thinking ultimately failed. But there's many interesting insights, because you can understand the motivations of the guy in Biden's earpiece. You can understand what they wanted and what they were trying to pursue in information war, in that aspect of net-centric warfare within the rubric of what's called fourth-generation warfare. And this is the psychology. So, in other words, Mearsheimer spent his career analyzing what were the causes of war insofar as the leadership of countries believed what the outcomes would be. So, in other words, to what extent could they make a rational assessment of what the probable outcomes would be, and that states were less likely to engage in a war if they had projected that the outcome would be a failure? This is pretty much common sense, but people get paid to put this stuff down on paper and they build careers on it. But he built on this. It's not that simple. Therefore, if one could somehow get into the minds of the leadership of another state and somehow get them to think that a military incursion that they might otherwise win, and to get them to think that they would lose it, then that would be a psychological operation upon the leadership of an otherwise belligerent state. Does that make sense? So in John Mearsheimer's worldview, he emphasizes several things. On the one hand, he recognizes the realism motivating Russian foreign policy. So this is at odds with the idealism that you see in liberal expressions that always focus on human rights or the emotional motivations of leaders, as if states are not acting in rational interest, but are acting upon ideas that may be wrong. And while that can happen, it can reduce the motivations of whole states down to the personalities of the leadership. And that's generally an inaccurate and wrong way to understand state-to-state relations. They're not determined by the personalities of the individual leaders in the country, unless you're talking about what's called a personality state, and those are pretty rare. You might have Cuba under Castro or Uganda under Idi Amin, and really nothing. Not even North Korea is a personality state. Okay, they have rational structures of leadership where they try to avoid the Abilene paradox, groupthink, and they divide teams A, B. They come up with different solutions to avoid wrong influences on decision-making processes. So. Now, Mearsheimer also goes further to explain that Russia's, because he's a realist, that their aims are rational, okay, and he would probably disagree with the NGO sphere and the Sorosian worldview, which is based in a type of neo-idealism towards realism outcomes. Okay, I don't want to complicate our understanding here, but neo-idealism towards realism outcomes. And he would be against that this use of soft power is going to deter effectively Russian motivations. But he's also been promoting the view that Russia would never invade Ukraine because the insurgency would be unmanageable. And of course, I don't mean just invade, but I mean occupy, a prolonged military occupation where there was an insurgency. Now, I think there's a fair point there, and there's two ways to address that. One, there's not a stated intention for there to be an occupation, but I think that the cultural and political assets and history between these two states make his formula quite wrong. And the analogy that he makes, in particular in his 2015 address at Chicago University, off the top of my head, he's very clear that this is during the period of when the conflict began in Russia and Ukraine with the Donbas and Lugansk, the Donbas rebellion in Donetsk and Lugansk, but also Kharkov, what we're seeing happen now. He was saying at this time that Russia wouldn't go further than this because, and for some reason, he associates an incursion with an occupation. In other words, that to have a success in an operation meant a sustained occupation. And that's an error in thinking right now, right there. But in addition to this, Mearsheimer seems to say that the best analogy is Afghanistan. And look what happened to the Russians or the Americans, he says. He's critical of that as well, in Afghanistan. But of course, Afghanistan is a mountainous terrain. It's a different history. It's the graveyard of empires and so forth. It's not at all like Ukraine in any way. And so it's very strange, right? In the political sciences, using a Millesian analysis, which is most similar systems, MSM or MDM, or MDS, most different systems analysis. So in looking at those two, in a Millesian analysis of looking at most similar versus and most different systems, why would you compare those two? Yet it conformed to the political needs of the US at the time, because the division between white hats and black hats over this question of foreign policy, which, as I have explained, primary, whereas human trafficking relates to another sector of the bureaucracy in the US, which has different motivations. But when you look at the foreign policy and questions of war and the emerging multipolarity, he is a product of a period before this division was so stark. So he speaks truths, right, lowercase t truths, to both camps. On the one hand, Russia's policies are rational. It's not crazy Putin. It could be any leader of Russia acting in Russia's interest would behave the same as Putin, right? So that's the criteria, and that's the test, that it's not Putin, not a personality state, right? And that their red lines should be respected. So it's very interesting that actually Mearsheimer seems to indeed have some sympathy with Russia's clarity, with the way that they address their needs, and the way that their needs have never wavered. They don't add things, they don't play games, they don't change, they don't basically engage in what's called regressive negotiating. So once they put their proposal and their needs forward, they don't move away from them at all. They don't amend their needs once certain needs have been met. They don't add to those needs, if you understand what I'm saying. So they don't engage in regressive bargaining. And this is very important to understand, because it sheds light on the thinking of people like Pompeo, who certainly understand Mearsheimer's worldview, right? And because this is, like I said, the foundation of U.S. International relations. Okay, and now what you're seeing between Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi and Biden are calling the divisions in America on the subject of Russia-Ukraine are because they actually ignored Mearsheimer. Okay, because if they would tell the honest truth to the public that the official view of foreign policy in ac from academia, and agreed with the military, agreed by with the military, was that Russia's need that Ukraine be neutral and that not be nuclear and not be NATO, right? Which absurdly is now being ignored, and it's even being flipped on its head, okay? Because if you actually look at the foundations of this conflict, it's because these needs were ignored, right? So the case study of Mearsheimer is so important to understand American strategic thinking and how they play the grand chessboard of geopolitics. It cannot be emphasized enough that he is a product of a time before this division in the leadership emerged. So the things he says will make sense to both sides if you time travel this back 15 years. Okay? But now that the things he warned about were not respected, which things that he was saying is that the Russian red lines have to be respected or you're going to have a conflict. But on the other hand, the things that he said may have misled American leadership, because he was so confident that even though Russia's needs are rational, that they wouldn't intervene militarily. And that was the conventional thinking. That was how we've been educated in this field. Even though you could come up with scenarios in which they would intervene or specific ways that they could intervene, that is a person simply is a product of an education, and they're going to think those things because of the way the evidence and the thinking has been produced. However, people who were studying the details of how the Russian NGO sphere and Russian paragovernmental or non-governmental organizations had been preparing the people in the east of the country for breakaway republics, for example, that of course Russia would, through third-party quasi-privatized sources, support that, like you saw in Lugansk and Donetsk. Those movements go back to right after the 2004 Orange Revolution, because the direction that things were going in a collision course for civil war in Ukraine or war between Russia and Ukraine were already understood back in 2004. So by 2008, these movements already existed in a very visible way. So that's the crash course on US strategic thinking in the field of international relations and why we got into this shit today. You have these relics of the past. Like Mearsheimer, who, had some good things to say, but also some of his thinking led to an inexcusable level of overconfidence on the part of the U.S. that Russia was inconceivable for them to do this. And another part of the thinking to conclude, and this really deserves its own subject, but I'll just include to be thorough as an introduction, is if you looked at the billions and billions and billions of dollars, I mean tens and tens of billions of dollars that Russian oligarchs lost overnight when this stuff went down during this week, last week, that was believed to be very destabilizing, and that all of these oligarchs would turn against the Russian government leadership, against the Kremlin, against Putin, and that it would foment this unrest, maybe assassination attempts and all of this, and improve the chances of getting the Russian oligarchy behind a pro deep state candidate, like they've been trying to do very weak and ineffective ways so far inside the Russian Federation. So that shows how much influence and intelligence networks have been able to manage the role of Russian oligarchs, which means that in Russia, the state has more power than the oligarchy. You understand? Whereas the problem in the US is that the oligarchy has created this deep state and has undermined the efficacy and rationality of the state. And that's the crisis in the United States and why you have this conflict, this white hat versus black hat conflict, this inter-elite conflict in the United States. And I hope this was useful for you. Have a great day. I know that I will. Take care.